A just-released study shows that here in our Aloha State, 1 in 11 males buy sex online. It's being tracked from our ZIP 808, so it may not just be transients like military and tourists. HBR's Kuvehi Hirishi joins us for a closer look.
Ah, yes. Good morning, Catherine. This is a way to start off the conversation.
Yes,
so, yes, a sex trafficking in Hawaii report, sort of a the first part of a multi-part study released by Arizona State University. They have an Office of Sex Trafficking Intervention Research, which is really interesting. So in partnership with our Hawaii State Commission on the Status of Women, have come out with these very startling statistics. So in this first part, they're looking at online sex buyers. So sort of the demand, where is it coming from? And what they found is what you said, 1 in 11 men in Hawaii search online to pay for sex. And that's something that really kind of, you know, it's going on. We're not sure how big that problem is. And this is that first glimpse at it.
I know when I saw the headlines in Sunday's paper, I was like, I don't know, I want to read this article. I was like, holy moly, Andy.
Yes, and you know, it's interesting for us, I think, as journalists, is we'll question that. How did you get to these numbers? So what happened was the researchers placed an online ad selling sex on what is now known as Backpage.com, but in April, the feds actually seized the website, so it's no longer active. But before that, back in March, the researchers placed an ad for the course of 24 hours here on Oahu and then also on the Big Island, and within that hour recorded the amount of responses and whether or not there were unique callers, and, you know, took statistics from there. So comparatively speaking, on Oahu, within the course of 24 hours, 400 unique, a little over 400 unique callers responded to this ad within the course of an hour. And that's compared to maybe like 20s and low 20s in other states. So Denver, Colorado, Boston, Massachusetts. I think the highest these researchers have ever found is 45 in Phoenix, Arizona. So 400 here in Hawaii.
And that's just Oahu?
That's just Oahu.
Okay.
And of that, you have about 70% with 808 numbers. So that's how they got to that idea that the 1 in 11 men here in Hawaii actually buy sex online.
What can you tell us about the neighbor islands, the Big Island?
The Big Island numbers were comparatively lower, but on the Big Island is what they looked at. We had about 200 or 100 unique callers or 808 numbers, not 808 numbers, but phone numbers, and 59% of them were local, were 808 numbers. So it's somewhat the same, but a smaller market for sure.
And what was the reaction from folks, from women's groups?
I think from the Kara Jabulis Carlos over at the Hawaii State Commission on Women, the Status of Women, she said she was surprised that there wasn't a lot of either military or transient numbers in on this. Now, there were a few, you know, they give examples in the study of folks calling in or texting and saying, I'm visiting from Reno. Can I do what, you know, mm-hmm. get this? But the numbers, and seeing that at least 70%, at least on Oahu, were 808 numbers or local, was eye-opening.
And so, gosh, I mean, what happens now? So we have these numbers. It's kind of like a, you know, like I said, a yikes.
It is. And I think I've been talking over the last month. We've been anticipating this study for some time now, looking at the sex trafficking industry here in Hawaii. And for the past month, I've been trying to key in, talking to some of our nonprofits who support the community, and also some of our enforcement folks, federal and local law enforcement. And everyone seems to have a grasp on what they can do here and now, but it's really helping. So these numbers will be sort of the first step for them to, for example, a nonprofit could go out and use this to get more funds to increase services to either victims or to try to crack down on the demand. That's a really tricky thing to do, just because, like we're saying, this is online. So how do you get to the point where you can go and catch someone in the act and then arrest them? So it's very hard law enforcement-wise.
And you just wonder, too, because you hear a lot of stories about underage you know, prostitution and folks getting involved in that trafficking, you know, whether they're runaways or, you know, just scooped up into this whole segment in our community.
And what's interesting about that, so that's the area I'm focusing on right now and speaking to some of the folks that are dealing with underage victims of prostitution and sex trafficking, is that online it brings a whole other element to it. We're no longer in this area of or this era of a snatch and grab where somebody will come and get you off the streets. That is still happening, but the bigger threat, or the threat that we can't see, is our kids online on Facebook chatting up some random guy who might be wanting to go ahead and meet her and then take her off to be sex trafficked. So that's the kind of, it's really changing the game, the internet.
And I remember doing a story once where the police officers were concerned because they were saying at some of the strip clubs in town that there were minors working in there and they were using, counterfeit driver's licenses that showed that they were older, but they really weren't. And so this whole thing about having special safeguards to make sure that our driver's licenses can't be duplicated is just fascinating.
It's that kind of thing. It really is. Wherever we can sort of touch and get in and intervene is really the tricky thing to do.
Right, because it's a whole business.
It is, and it's getting more sophisticated, like you said, as we see this thing evolve. But getting that first grasp on what it looks like in terms of demand, maybe that'll help us figure out what we can do to fix the problem.
Do we know what else the study's going to be looking at?
Yeah, so they're going to be looking at victims, sort of characterizing who these girls or boys are, what if they're runaways. We know that, you know, the different background, sort of demographic on them, and then also what the agencies, law enforcement and nonprofit can do to help make this not be a problem anymore.
Yeah, because it's a real eye-opener.
It really is. It really is.
And how long before these studies
The next study installment will be released in January. Yes, so we'll have an idea of what these victims look like, what they're going through, and then what we can do about it.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much, Kuvehi.
Yes, ma'am.
You can find Kuvehi's reports online at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz, and you're listening to The Conversation on HPR1.
Aloha, my name is Emily Cardinelli from National Public Radio. If you like today's music, find the playlist at The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org.
All this week, we are spotlighting local films. Earlier this month, a documentary film entitled Rise of the Wahine, Champions of Title IX, was re-released with the idea it might reach a new audience and help educators share the story. We sat down with Dean Kaneshiro to talk about his passion to document the fight for equity in athletics and the legacy of remarkable women here in Hawaii, Congresswoman Patsy Mink and School Superintendent Donis Thompson. Both of those women fought those early battles. Kaneshiro talks about a recent event at the Hawaii Theater to celebrate the recut of the film and its release online.
Yes, it was a wonderful time, and it was fantastic because Hawaiian Miles was a partner of ours, and they sponsored this presentation, which was a celebration of now, shucks, you know, 7 years, 6 years of production and post-production and editing and cutting and putting this together. But it was a celebration with folks who were in the film, obviously the UH community, the Hawaii community, people who were a part of the film, Patsy's, some folks from Patsy's family. And we were able to celebrate not just this recut of the film, but really now releasing it online, so that people really anywhere in the world can now watch it.
And the significance of Title IX?
Yes. So, you know, honestly, when I first heard the story in 2010, I know nothing of Title IX. I'll just confess that out loud. And knew very little of Dr. Donis Thompson, who was the first woman's athletic director here at the UH in the early 1970s, really late 60s. When she came, Patsy Mink, of course, knew her name, but didn't know much more than that. And I've always watched Wahine volleyball on television, but didn't know that those three groups and of people and groups together really have this incredible story that happened right here in Hawaii in my own backyard, and I knew nothing of it. And the story spans all the way to Washington, D.C., where they're fighting. Patsy Mink, of course, the first Asian-American woman, first woman of color elected to Congress. Dr. Donis Thompson was an African-American woman from Chicago over here on this side. And then Beth McLaughlin, who was the first team captain of the first UH Wahine volleyball team in the early 1970s. And these three women, kind of, we just follow their interweaving stories. Of course, Dave Shoji is a part of that and others. So from Washington, D.C. and fighting for Title IX there, as well as then what was happening here locally and what did that battle look like here for equity in women's athletics. And of course, we talk about Title IX and educate folks just a little bit on that. Patsy Mink's role, not just as a co-author, but then as a champion of it to keep athletics within the bill. Because right after Title IX was signed, no one really knew that it was going to really include athletics. And then what did that mean, right? It was an education bill in that sense. Birch Bayh, of course, and Edith Green and others were a part of that. But it basically prohibits sex discrimination in any federally funded institution. And during that time, in the film, Dr. Bernice Sandler, who's known as the godmother of Title IX, we got to interview her, which is a humongous blessing. And so she was telling stories, just, you know, hey, we have two women in our law department. That's it. We're closed. You know, hey, we only have one woman. We take no women. It was just arbitrary that anybody could just do whatever they wanted. And so this originally was just a bill that said, hey, you can't do that anymore, basically. But once the NCAA and other coaches and football coaches and everything woke up to the fact, wait, what do you mean we have to share money? Does it have to be equal money with women now and these young ladies in college? So that's where the controversy exploded. And so from that happening on a national level and Patsy Mink being the leader of that fight to keep Title IX just the way it is, down to Donis Thompson, Beth, Dave, and others here locally birthing this little program with $5,000 and nothing to their name to try to make that alive. That's really what the film does, is bounce between those two and help us to understand, wow, what did these people have to do to create what we know today?
No, I was very fortunate to have covered Patsy Mink and Donis Thompson when she was with the DOE. But like you mentioned, you didn't know them, and you're really bent on keeping the story alive for the up-and-coming generation so they appreciate
Correct.
What we've got.
Oh, yeah, definitely, right. And you would know. I mean, you're there. The difference between you and, let's say, my daughter, who's 12, you know, and my second daughter, or even just the young men that I have in my house, too. I have six kids in all, but from 17 down to two. And they walk in, oh, I can be president of America. I can run this company. You know, these young ladies today, what they have and what they can see and what they can dream for, women that you were covering and you ran with and the doors that you were opening to during those years in the early 70s, which is not too far. I mean, we just throw a stone, you know, back in time. And that's life was so different. I mean, women were running half court in basketball. You know, I interviewed Pat Psyche and she's like, I couldn't even run full court because they thought, you know, we were going to injure ourselves or something. Now, you watch women playing basketball on television. They'll kill me. If I got on the court, I would die. They would run over me and destroy me. And so the world that young women and girls are, thank God, but they're birthed into it today, but they just don't know that who had to fight and battle and sacrifice to give them what they have today.
Right, the opportunities they have today.
Yeah, so thank God for the opportunities. So, but it's just a story that says, hey, this is what it took to get there. But I do want to say this, especially obviously being a man too, it was more so me going, wow, this is how you change things. So it's not just a film for women, of course, and girls. I really want men and young men as well to not just open their hearts to the struggles of women, but it really crosses even sports fans even. It goes beyond athletics because really these folks were really changing culture. So that's really what the core message is in the first line of the film, and it's narrated by a good friend of mine, Sarah Wayne Callies, who's an actress in Hollywood, Prison Break, The Walking Dead. We went to high school together. But she starts by asking, what does it take to change the world around you? And so that was a humongous journey for me. And I'm telling you, these women, Faith Evans, and Pat Psyche and others, when you're talking to them, Eve Anderson, I mean, they would go fight to, like, the drop of a hat, they would go into the battle. And that fire that they had in their bones, even to this day, many of them, some have passed away, impressed upon me greatly.
I remember there was a story, Patsy Mink said her daughter Wendy had wanted to run for student council when she was in elementary school. And the teacher said, oh, you don't want to run for president, run for vice president.
Yeah, maybe you can be the vice, because we got a young boy here who wants to. That's right. Wendy told that story. Actually, we couldn't put it in the film because there was just so much information, so many great stories. But that showed Patsy, wait a minute, this is now, for my daughter, this is happening. And so that was a part of the fire, you know. And when she first went, you know, to Washington, she was representing Hawaii, you know, and us. But when she got there, she recognized, whoa, there's a whole nother population, just women in general, who are not being represented as well. And so her shift of focus was able to, you know, really zero in on those specific battles, too. So, you know, and this woman's from Maui. This woman's from this little place. Who knows? I mean, she's short. She's in the middle of nowhere. It's like, that's another part of the message that I wanted to get across, is it doesn't matter where you are, where you're born, what you look like, what color, like, you can change things. And what people don't know, and Hawaii needs to know, is that Title IX has been renamed in 2002 after she passed away, right, to her name, to Patsy T. Mink, Equal Opportunity and Education Act. I may have said that a little wrong, but I think that's what it is, Equal Opportunities and Education Act. And that's because she defended Title IX the way she did. But no one's talking about that. We need to know that.
Right, so a tiny lady who did great things.
Amazing thing. After being denied over and over and over again, 12-plus times, you can't go to medical school. You can't follow your dream. That's why she went to law school. And I think that she became a hero of mine, because how easy do we give up in life? So easy with the dreams that we have.
And what made you decide to pursue this film? Because I know you worked on it with Ryan Tsuji, and I remember for years I would listen to Ryan, I'm working on this documentary about Patsy Mink and Donna Thompson.
Yes, and of course Ryan Tsuji, who's a co-producer on the film, he was an assistant coach, right, with Dave Shoji for 8 years. And so he's very familiar with the program. So I knew him through some contacts, and I just said, hey, can you get me an interview with Dave? But then after a while, I just kept asking him, can you find me this person? And then Marilyn Moniz Ohanohano at UH, et cetera. And then he said, just give me your list, and then let's just do this together. You know. And I also reached out to a friend of mine, Tiffany, who's in L.A., who was a producer on the film as well. And so between the three of us, we were able to get different dynamics, different perspectives. And she really helped as well with the story, because we didn't want to make it too Hawaii-centric either. And so her and her crew in L.A. were able to help us say, hey, what is going to make this most palatable to everybody in the nation and beyond as well? So the three of us really worked for many, many years, and lots of edits, lots of cuts, trying to make it as exciting and dynamic for young people especially.
Right, the best film you could, and you've now re-released it. It's tighter and available.
Yes, it
online.
Is. It is available online. Yep, it's at riseofthewahinefilm.com. So it's a new site for us, riseofthewahinefilm.com. And folks can then click through there and then, purchase it. They can rent it. There's a special educator's version there, because there's bonus features. Because I had so much film, I had so much amazing interviews, I cut another 14, just kind of raw cut sort of interviews, a lot with Wendy Mink, Dr. Bernice Sandler, lots of others.
Lots of depth.
Lots of depth, yeah. And I didn't get pretty with it. I just kind of cut it, but long stuff. Lots about Donna, lots about Patsy's history, sex discrimination in the 70s, just other things that students who want to learn, especially about Title IX and what life was like back then, can watch those pieces there. So there's an educator's version that's licensed for classrooms and sports teams and special interest groups. And then there's also a form there for folks who want to screen the film. And now I'm working with some people on the mainland. They want to do fundraisers for sports teams and screen. But it's a family-friendly, you know, film. It's 75 minutes long. But it does move. And I'd say middle school age. We've screened it for 7th graders through 11th, and they can comprehend it. There is some history in there, of course. But it's an emotional film. It's a moving film. It's personal stories. And I think it's going to be inspiring for everybody, really, but hopefully especially for young people.
And I can tell you're proud of it.
I'm very proud of it, and I'm very happy, like another child that I'm releasing into the world, saying, go now and touch lives, you know, and challenge people. And again, I really hope dads and young men sit down, because that's what actually caused me to do the film. I said, you know what, as a man, I don't understand what these women have gone through. I want to just sit for a while and just listen and learn. And I think my life has been changed. My heart has been changed. And I'm trying to raise my sons to be sensitive as well to these kinds of issues.
Well, mahalo to you, Dean, and to Ryan for pursuing this for years. I know
it's
taken a long time.
It's a labor of love. Yeah, riseofthewahinefilm.com. Folks can go there. They can reach out to us. They can purchase. They can rent and share it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dean Kaneshiro is the director, writer, and producer of the Rise of the Wahine Champions of Title IX. Born and raised in Hawaii, he's a local actor, video producer, and marketing director, as well as a husband of 20 years and a father of 6 children.
Keeping up with the day's nonstop breaking political news is no mean feat, but don't worry, we've got you covered. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Join me for America on the Line, a live national news and call-in program about the midterm elections from WNYC. We'll have the latest developments, updates on key races, and your voice. America on the Line, every Monday through Thursday.
Hear this program live this afternoon at 2.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. There's an interesting story from Kauai about the life and death of a resident there. Kauai columnist Alan Peruccini is on the line with us. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
So what inspired you to write this story?
Well, I'm familiar with the Anahola Marketplace and Robin Danner by reputation and working with her for a number of years, and I started to see social media posts on this episode that related to a series of drag performances that the Anahola Marketplace had started to put on, and the series was unfortunately interrupted after one performance by the unfortunate suicide death of this individual. And it just seemed from what I could see in terms of what was being written about it and how the community had come together to come up with a fundraiser to provide the family with enough money for a funeral and other burial expenses, and what people had to say about him. He came across, he had many friends, a lot of people were very, very loyal, respectful, enjoyed his performances. He was apparently also a very gifted karaoke person. And it just seemed like it had all the ingredients of human interest and tragedy to make it a story of pretty broad interest.
And Dylan Kuamura had just lost his job, too, right?
He had been a flight attendant for Island Air, and when they went under, I believe that was October of last year, but don't hold me to that, he was laid off, and he had difficulty getting other employment, and ironically and tragically, he had been pursuing a position with Hawaiian Airlines, which the day after he died, they called to offer him a job.
Oh, I know. So tragic. So tragic.
Yeah. And it's just a very, very widely tragic situation. It has tragic written all over it. And I think the important thing here is, and there has been a little pushback today from some community members about describing the some of the details, particularly the means of death in the story, to which I say that I think we as we know from Mayor Carvalho's little impromptu speech at the performance the other night, that Kauai has a suicide problem. We have a suicide epidemic on our hands on this island, actually. And if we don't talk about it, it's not going to get any better. So I think there's a broader public interest in having a conversation about what's happening here, even though I realize it's a painful experience for his family and friends.
Right. There's a lot of despair, but then if you can reach out to people, if you sense that something's not quite right, you can maybe save a life.
I think that's true, and this is another example of how there are limits to what you can accomplish. A number of his good friends really thought he was out of the woods, apparently. And they were the ones who were most shocked by the fact that he died. So it's often true in these situations that what you think you're seeing and comprehending as what's happening with a person really isn't. And are there better ways to divine what may actually be going on in that person's mind and what behavior you should be recognizing that you're not?
Right, if there are mental health issues, or I think you had mentioned in the article he might have battled some addiction problems in the past.
Correct. And, I mean, this is, by its very nature, a mental health issue. Every suicide is, I think. And so the better the understanding of what this guy was going through and what might have been recognized to produce a different outcome is all for the better. And having a discussion to include how he died still gets to the objective of what behaviors and hints of behaviors or actions can you recognize that might be getting past you.
Right, right. But thank you for the story, Alan. Thanks very much.
Sure enough.
That was Sybil Beats Quay columnist Alan Parrucchini with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit sybilbeat.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the evangelical sexual purity and abstinence movement with Linda K. Klein. Her new book, Pure, is part memoir, including the story of how she left the church. It's also based on conversations she's had with other women about how the evangelical purity movement has affected their sense of identity and their sex lives. Join us.
This afternoon at 3.
Denise Yamaguchi is chief executive officer of the Hawaii Food and Wine Festival, which has events kicking off across the state. Now, she's helped to raise more than $2 million for culinary education and agricultural programs. The festival's mission supports future chefs and helps to create markets for local crops.
October is our month for Hawaii Food and Wine Festival, and we start on October 6th, and it goes all the way through October 28th. We start on the Big Island with Under the Tuscan Sun, and then we move over to Maui, and we have four amazing events there. New this year to Maui will be a smaller keiki in the kitchen, and then we go over to Honolulu, where we have 4 days, October 24th through October 28th, where we have over 15 events for all different kinds of folks.
And you folks are trying to showcase kind of up-and-coming crops.
Yes, we are. In fact, the mission of the Hawaii Food and Wine Festival is really to promote sustainability and agriculture here in our islands. And one of the events that we have this year is called Hard Hughes Presents Crops and Hops. And it really, it's featuring emerging crops. That's what crops and hops is. It's emerging crops. And emerging crops are those that are, we're able to potentially scale for commercial production. And this year we have a competition with our chefs, and the product that they're using, we had 10 chefs submit recipes using moringa, which is otherwise known as kulamangay, you know, used in a lot of Filipino dishes. We have three chefs that have been chosen as finalists, Chef Michael Ginor from Lola in New York, Chef Antonio Tomasi from Macaroni Republic in Los Angeles, and Chef Eric Oto from right here from Hoku's at the Kahala will be competing on October 24th at Crops and Hops. And we also have five other chefs using emerging crops, and some of those crops will be turmeric, chickpeas, calamansi, tilapia, breadfruit. And so we'll have 11 chefs total there at that event, and they'll all be paired with a beer event that we're having for the first time. And we'll be showcasing 30 different beers from Anheuser-Busch's portfolio as well as Southern Wine's portfolio. And we'll also have a little bit of wine and a little bit of cocktail because we are Hawaii Food and Wine Festival.
Well, now, I grew up eating breadfruit, ulu, and we used to just bake it with coconut milk. Or fry it as chips. But I tried something recently in the store, which was ulu with turmeric, and it was really a delicious dip.
I've tried some at the Made in Hawaii Festival with all different kinds of flavorings, and that's one of the emerging crops that I think the state is hoping we can scale. In fact, one of the things that they're trying to do with ulu right now is try to make it into a flower, but you need a huge amount of scale for that. And I believe on the Big Island, Kamehameha Schools and others are trying to help the ulu farmers. I mean, there's not one farmer that can scale that big, so there's a cooperative now on the Big Island that's really trying to get ulu production going.
Yeah, I was just over at Whole Foods, and I was surprised to see breadfruit there on the counter. So, you know, they're really trying to market it across the board.
Yeah, apparently it's the new flour because if they can develop it, it's gluten-free.
Oh, I see.
The possibilities are endless for ulu,
terrific.
Right?
Gosh, you've got all these different events, so these competitions, so it's the kind of thing where, what, the audience can then watch them compete? Do they get to sample?
Yeah, those three chefs will be cooking with moringa, and there'll be a panel of judges, and I believe Alan and Roy are part of that panel along with three other judges. And then there'll be a fan favorite, and the participants will be able to taste the different dishes that these three chefs will be cooking along with the other five chefs, and they'll be able to judge.
And then you have this event on the Big Island that's coming up, October 6th, you said.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the proceeds from that event will go to help our farmers?
Yes, so on October 6th, we have an event at the Marriott Waikoloa, and it is called Under the Tuscan Sun. And a portion of the proceeds from that event will go to support the disaster relief for farmers because of what happened with what's happening with the volcanic ash, as well as with some of the flooding that has happened here in Honolulu as well as Kauai.
Right, and we've had situations with the VOG affecting the growth cycles of crops on the Big Island, so really lots of challenges there.
Now, there's lots of challenges, not just for those that are producing food, but I also hear that our floral industry is suffering because of the volcanic ash. So if we can help some of those farmers get back on their feet, that's what we hope to do.
And then you folks are really trying to encourage skills with our keiki.
Yes. So
tell us about that.
The Hawaii Food and Wine Festival, about 5 years ago, started this event called Keiki in the Kitchen. And as part of that event, we've had something called the Localicious Recipe Contest. And what we do is encourage kids in grades 4 through 8 and 9 through 12 to submit a recipe that they've created. It's an original recipe they created that uses at least one locally grown, caught, or raised product. And last year's winner in the grade 4 through 8 category was Achilles Yoshihara, who made a delicious macadamia nut crusted mahi-mahi. And, you know, some of these kids, it's pretty cool to see what's happened to them because we're already in our fifth year. And one of them, Hunter Haskell, he is going on to the Culinary Institute of America at Greystone.
Awesome.
And then we had another young woman, Sophia Stark, who's homeschooled. And she's gone on to a nationally televised program, and she also became Miss Teen USA recently. So a lot of these kids are pretty amazing, and it's great to watch them through the years. So, yeah, it's been a great event.
And I know I've seen a number of our young keiki actually compete, like you mentioned, on cooking shows, which is great. I mean, what an experience to have as a kid.
Yeah, this year we'll be featuring this kid from Cleveland who was on Chopped Junior. And my husband, Roy Yamaguchi, was a judge last season. And one of the prizes was a trip for two to Hawaii and an opportunity to appear at Hawaii Food and Wine Festival. So he'll be one of the judges for the Localicious Recipe Contest.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
I want to mention, though, that the Recipe Contest submission deadline is this Friday, September 21st. So if you have a keiki that's interested in cooking and is very creative in the kitchen, please go ahead and look us up online, hawaiifoodandwinefestival.com, and encourage them to submit the recipe.
And now, I know when you put a festival like this together, you draw from so many companies and businesses that really support the culinary effort.
This festival is pretty amazing. We have over 76 corporate sponsors that participate in Hawaii Food and Wine Festival. And through ticket sales and through the sponsorship, we've generated over $2.1 million over the last 7 years that goes to the different culinary schools across the state. In the 7 years, we've given over $500,000 to the Culinary Institute of the Pacific. And added to that, we've given another $450,000 to the culinary programs on Maui, Big Island, and in Honolulu. So it's pretty amazing. And the rest of the monies have gone to other agricultural programs that, you know, we support.
And it's just amazing, too, the whole food scene, how Hawaii's just really been put on the map, you know. It's exciting.
It is very exciting. For me, over the last, this is going to be my eighth year, just to see how much interest there is now in food in Hawaii, but also how many new chefs have either our young chefs have gotten into the national scene and have had their profile raised because media will come here for the festival and interview them. I mean, we've seen a lot of the younger chefs in national publications, like Chris Kajioka has been featured a number of times. Chef Mark Noguchi has been featured a number of times. And just to see this budding young chef talent grow has been really inspiring. And the other thing is we've also seen a lot of nationally recognized chef with James Beard Awards, with Michelin stars, now attracted to Hawaii. And I really feel that when we started this festival, I don't know that they had a lot of confidence in the agricultural products that we were growing here in our islands. And Chef Michael Mina told me, hey, you know what really made me feel like I could have a great restaurant here was when I saw the kinds of agricultural products that you're growing in the islands and what that bounty looks like and what I would be able to do with it. So the festival has done a lot for, I believe, the state of Hawaii, not just in terms of the chef talent, but also in terms of our agriculture.
Right, we've come a long way from sugar.
Yes, we have.
And so, yeah, as we explore diversified ag, just imagine all the things that will end up on your plate.
No, it's pretty amazing. I mean, there's a lot of fallow agricultural lands, and I think there's a lot of initiative toward looking at what can grow in different regions across our state. And I think Senator De La Cruz has done an amazing job with the Growlithe lands and with Whitmore Village and trying to really put together a plan where agricultural can be sustainable. I mean, you need a lot of things beyond just farmers. You need housing, you need infrastructure, you need processing, you need food safety. You just need a whole lot of resources to make agriculture sustainable in one community. And I think hopefully if that succeeds, and it looks like it's moving in that direction, there'll be other pockets here on our islands that will be able to replicate what they're doing out in Whitmore and in Galbraith.
Right, because I know there's great potential. I know with all the large utility scale solar farms, you know, they've got, you know, sheep there, and the opportunity for lamb, for mm-hmm. locally produced lamb. The other day I had something called prosciutto chips, which just was like, wow, you know.
Oh, I haven't had that yet.
It's just, you know, so little things like that, but in a just presented in a different way, mm-hmm. can just kind of like waken up your taste buds.
It's totally
exciting.
I mean, it's great to see that the value-added chain, you know, the chain, which includes value-added products, is also growing. You know, this Made in Hawaii festival that I went to, I just saw so many new, different products being created using our local agriculture. So
right. We've got Kualoa Ranch, I think, doing oysters. Mm-hmm. I mean, just, you know,
and we have a lot
right?
more beef industry.
That's true, we do.
So a lot more cattle, heads of cattle here now. And, you know, there's you know, the sky's the limit in terms of what we'll be able to do in the future.
Lots of possibilities.
Yes.
All right. Food and Wine Festival. Can't wait.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for joining us. And a heads up again on the Kiki in the Kitchen recipe contest. The deadline for entries is September 21st, which is at the end of this week. Six finalists will be chosen to cook their dishes live in front of celebrity chef judges at the Hawaii Food and Wine Festival's Kiki event on October 28th, which is the closing day.
Hi, I'm Neil Milner. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or at Google Play.
Mm-hmm.
Kimono Couture is Ann Namba's brand. Born out of a love for antique kimono and obi, the fashion designer sat down with us to talk about an upcoming fashion show to raise money for the Hawaii Opera Theater. This year, it's all about East meets Italy, with Romeo and Juliet as the inspiration. Ann Namba recalls how the fashion shows first got started.
I started doing costumes for their different productions, and we were bringing Madame Butterfly in, which I had actually collaborated with Henry Akina and Dean Shibuya over in Finland. And we actually brought it back to Honolulu, and so we decided, well, let's showcase it. Let's do a little fashion show. Let's have some of the arias sung in between the fashion. And it was such a hit that we've done it ever since, so this will be our seventh year.
Okay, so but tell us about this one.
So this one, the theme is Romeo and Juliet. It's being held at the Halekulani on Sunday the 30th. What we started doing about 3 years ago was we started using, instead of professional models, we started using role models from the community. So it's always a lot of fun because you get a lot of the ladies that love the opera or love my fashions or love just being at the Halekulani having brunch and having
there
fun.
There you go. So. And having coconut cake, I think.
And champagne, yeah. So, and it's a wonderful event. So we started using community role models to do all the modeling, and it's a huge hit. So every year we sell out. People love the event. It's a lovely brunch. And I just do three different segments of fashion.
But so tell us how you are working the whole Romeo and Juliet theme.
Well, that's the challenging part.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
So I'm kind of doing brocades, velvets, that kind of thing. There have been so many different interpretations of Romeo and Juliet, even to be modern, contemporary. So I'm just not trying to get so stereotyped with the look. Trying to keep it romantic, dramatic, and using some of the, you know, fancier, more ornate type looks.
Right.
As well.
So is there more than an oriental feel to this?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm doing some things that people go, wait, that's Ann Namba? Because it doesn't even look like my stuff.
And so I guess what's been the most fun thing that's maybe different with this compared to, say, Madame Butterfly?
Well, this one, every year it's different. We try to get different role models to do the modeling. So working with different people, that's always fun to do, changing up the music. Halekulani is just wonderful to work with, and they just always do a fabulous brunch. And, you know, different crowd that comes. I have a lot of other different people this year saying, oh, I can hardly wait to come to the show. They've never been before. So it's always nice to do a nice performance. The arias are going to be different, three different arias by three different singers. And I'm also going to introduce some of my newer collections as well.
And so how long does it take to come up with, you know, these ideas for a show like this?
I've been thinking about it for quite some time since we nailed down the date. And then a lot has to do with who are the role models that we are using. People, a lot of times when we ask them, they go, oh, no, I'm not thin, I'm not tall. And it's like, no, that's not what we're looking for. We want to show all types of body types that are average and more normal.
Right, right.
and so then I sort of design with that in mind as well.
Where do you find your fabric and you know, how do you weave that into the whole plan?
Oh, well, I travel a lot. So I was just in New York, and I was able to catch the costume display over at the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Yes, I saw that. That's fabulous.
Yeah, and so that influenced me a lot. And that actually, a lot of that can be sort of translated into sort of a Romeo-Juliet type feel. And I also shop the fabric market there, get a lot of textiles. I also travel the world. So I was in India. I got a bunch of things there. And actually, I'm on my way over to the West Coast. So I'm always being influenced and inspired by my travels and just driving over here. I was just listening to opera music, so I got inspired there, too.
Well, now, do you actively seek, let's say, the garment district, or do you just go to areas in a city and, you know, just stumble across things?
No, I don't have time to stumble.
Okay.
I am very planned, very definite where I'm going. I've got everything just
You did the research.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And so what's been maybe the most fun thing you've come across planning for this Romeo and Juliet show?
I think I've got some really rich brocades and some sort of beaded trims, also some cut-out velvets, And so I you know, and it's very romantic, very flowy. So I'm going to work in some silks as well, and just so that it's softness mixed in with the more structured brocades.
What's the toughest type of fabric to work with?
Probably something very, very slippery. Like charmeuse.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have any of that in this show?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yeah, that's difficult to work with. Anything that's really light, super sheer is also hard to work with. Another, you know, chiffons. So I do have that in the show as well.
I have, like, no patience when it comes to machines. I mean, you know, I tried to learn how to sew, you know, but it's like everything I make falls apart after the first washing.
Yeah, I think you have to just really get into it and really like it, because I, for example, have no patience for, like, writing letters and things like that. Or doing numbers. Oh, my God. So I think it just depends on your you know, what you're passionate about.
And do you have a favorite machine?
Yeah, it's my machine and my scissors, and nobody is allowed to go near it.
And so tell us about this machine. Where did you get it?
Oh, it's so, so old. But it's sort of like, you know, you get used to working with certain machinery and certain things. So you know when somebody touches your stuff, and it's just like our scissors. That's probably the most possessive thing that any of us own is our scissors, and no one's allowed to touch it, because I have 6 pairs of scissors, and each one is for a different type of fabric, and as soon as it starts getting dull, I have to get it sharpened. So, yeah, people are like, what? And I can't stand to cut with dull scissors. So it drives me absolutely insane.
So how often do you have to sharpen your your?
Well, I have, like, backups to the regular ones I use as well. So every 6 months or so.
And then you say you do research before you go out on your buying trips. But is there, like, I don't know, just an unexpected surprise? Maybe you were looking for one thing and found something else.
Oh, yeah. So I have, like, I'll be going to New York this fall. I go to the fabric, the industry, to where all the textile stores are, and I have my favorites there. But a lot of times, they know I'm coming, and when I come in, they go, oh, let me show you the newest thing I have. And so then I'm finding things that, like on my last trip to New York, I found this crochet fabric, which I had no idea. I wasn't looking for it, but I saw it, and I thought, oh, this will work perfectly with what I'm doing, so just bought it. So that was a nice surprise, and it was working out really well.
What about, like, the kind of the, what do they call it, performance material that you see in a lot of, like, these athletic stores where the fabric is just so high-tech and just...
Right, and I've been doing that as well. So you may even see some leggings in the show.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah, I'll work with a lot of spandex. I've done, actually, washable collections that are where I had to research the fabric very extensively and do a lot of testing to make sure that, number one, I could print on it my specific prints, and that the fabric was all that I wanted it to be, with having good drape, retaining the color, the print, yet it was washable, it was dry, you know, dry, throw it in the dryer, it didn't wrinkle. And I have actually ventured into that world.
And then of the collection that you have for this show, for the upcoming show, is there, I mean, what happens to the clothing after you
Well, hopefully we sell it all. So it is all for sale. And actually, it's funny, because when the models do come in for fittings, a lot of times they're like, I'm buying that. So it's like when people come backstage afterwards, where is that outfit that so-and-so was wearing? It's like, oh, she's got it. So
is there any one that maybe you just couldn't part with?
There's a few pieces every now and then that I just like, no, this is mine. I can't let it go.
Like what? What do you
Well, mean? I just had my fall preview show, and I was given a buckle by my friend Anna Meng, who does all my jewelry, and it's a dragon head silver buckle. And I made it into this fabulous belt, which I showed in my fashion show. And I had so many people wanting to buy it. I'm like, nope, this is mine.
Not for sale. Well, that's great. And anything else you just want to share with us? Just about, you obviously have a lot of fun doing what you do, and
yes,
it really touches a lot of people, because you just bring in a lot of that culture and then you transform it.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've been doing this actually almost 30 years now.
Wow.
That I've been in business, which is pretty long for a fashion designer. And it's still fun. I'm still passionate about it. I still get excited. I find new things all the time. It enables me to travel the world, and I see it in different view because I'm looking at the textiles and the colors and getting inspiration and always thinking, ooh, how can I translate that into something I can create, you know, for my store? And it could be even displays, anything. But I'm constantly, I think when you're a creative person, you look at the world differently. You're always looking at getting ideas from things where people might see a chair as a chair. I see it as, look at the patterns and how the fabric was sewn together.
And how it catches the light.
It's just very different that way.
Yeah, well, can't wait to see the show.
I'm excited about it.
September 30th. Okay.
September 30th, yes.
All right, well, thank you so much for sitting down with us.
You're very welcome.
Again, that hot event at the Halekulani Hotel is at the end of the month.
Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, it's our live nonfiction game show, Tell Me Something I Don't Know.
I am an astronaut. I got to fly twice on the space shuttle. And both of my missions, I went to the Hubble Space Telescope and repaired it. And I was also the first person to tweet from space. There you go.
An astronaut, a Catalan, and two linguists walk into a bar. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
This evening at 7.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we continue our look at locally produced films with Malka de Mackay. Tell us what's on your mind, call our talkback line, and leave us a comment in your voice. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.